Need a reason to smile? Comfort Dental has you covered with new patient exams, including x-rays, for just $19. That's right, only $19 to get started on a healthier, brighter smile. With convenient locations, flexible hours, including evenings and Saturdays, and a team that truly cares, Comfort Dental makes dental care easy and affordable. No gimmicks, no stress, just quality care when you need it. Get comfortable with Comfort Dental. Call or visit ComfortDental.com today.
To do. Give me the sunshine, give me a dew. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing mountain dew. So give me my good friends, give me a dew.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew!
Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to another episode of The Interviews, the spin-off show that rounds up the Empire Podcast's chats with cinema's biggest and brightest. This week sees release of Ready or Not 2, Here I Come, the long-awaited follow-up to the 2019 comedy horror film Ready or Not, from directors Radio Silence aka Matt Bettinelli-Ulpin and Tyler Gillette. That saw Samara Weaving star as a young woman whose dream wedding turns out to be a nightmare, when her new family play a deadly game of hide and seek with her. Spoiler alert, she won, they lost. But there's no time for Grace to celebrate her victory, because a sequel picks up exactly where the last film left off and pits Weaving against a new shadowy cabal of psycho killers while throwing her sister Faith, played by Catherine Newton, into the mix. You're about to hear an extended interview that I did recently with Radio Silence and Weaving. It is spoiler free, although we do talk about certain sequences in the first half of the movie, so maybe listen to this after you've seen the film so you can't shout at me. There will be a dedicated spoiler special interview with Matt and Tyler, which will be available on our spoiler special feed after the film is released. But in the meantime, here you go. This is my interview with this tremendous trio, who also, by the way, worked together briefly on Scream 6, where Weaving was the big name cameo dispatched in the opening sequence. Oh, there's another spoiler, you can shout at me about that as well. Yikes. Had a lot of fun with this Zoom chat. Enjoy. First things first, what is the title of this movie in your eyes? Because we're presented...
Oh man, the hard-hitting questions.
You right out of the answer.
I keep leaving the two out.
Same.
On purpose.
Yeah.
Same. On purpose.
Ready or not, here I come.
Yeah, I keep going, ready or not, here I come, in cinemas.
Well, and we did that in the movie, too. It's like you can kind of barely see the two.
Oh, the two was there, because I've only seen the film once. So I was like,
and
the
you
title
missed
card.
It. You missed
I missed it.
You blinked. Okay. Fantastic.
Okay, that's good, because it for me, when you're playing hide and seek, whether you're killing people or not, when you count down, you go, ready or not, here I come. You don't go, ready or not, two. Here I come. So I was just wondering if you
that
were on board.
Too.
We've had this conversation many times.
Yeah, you're picking at an old wound.
Yeah, you want. Salt in the wound.
Maybe we'll start a trend. Maybe people will start saying two.
Yeah.
Okay. Or,
yeah. Equally, if you were to make a sequel to this movie, it could be Ready or Not 3, Here I Come 2. Would that be...
really confuse people.
I like to confuse people rightfully off in interviews. But so in terms of picking at an old wound, how long ago were all three of you really actively in earnest discussing this movie? And did you have that title right from the off?
I like honestly have been asked that and I don't remember. Because it felt like when we were doing the first one, the second one, that wasn't even a...
No, not even a...
A thought, not even a whisper.
No, we were just like all white-knuckling it, like hoping the first one we'd actually pull it off.
Yeah. Yeah. We're like, we're enjoying this weird, wonderful one-off thing. I hope the rest of the world does too. So it was such a surprise, an incredible, exciting surprise that sort of the fans were the reason why we were even starting to have conversations, but I don't remember
when we first talked about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we shortly after the release, and it like kind of, you know, was building a bit of a following in its, you know, early in its release, we had the conversation about what the sequel could be. And it was called Ready or Not, Here I Come. Like that was
a very early pitch.
A very early idea. And it was also from jump was the sequel was going to continue right where the first movie left off. That
Is
was
that
also,
right?
Yeah, it was also, you know, very much just a part of the pitch from jump. And, but I feel like we were all aware, cause we all knew that we were going to have to lock arms to make a sequel. And so I think there was an awareness that we were designing something, mm-hmm. but I don't remember. I don't think maybe it wasn't until there was a script, Sam, that we actually sent you something creative to give thoughts on. And then
we had a dinner.
2019?
Yeah. Bit of a blur.
Bit of a blur.
At some point, and then COVID hit.
Yeah.
But it's been in our lives ever since. So it's like this, it's kind of just always, ever since we did it, it's kind of been there and it's kind of come and gone for, I think, all of us on some level. Mm-hmm. Not you. You were there.
Yeah. And then it very suddenly seemed to all fall into place.
Okay.
Like it went from being quite ambiguous to like, and now we're signing the papers, I guess?
Yeah, we're going in a couple months.
Now we're in Toronto? Okay.
Yeah.
Because, Samara, you, we interviewed you, a colleague of mine interviewed all three of you for Empire Magazine for a feature. And you said to her, Samara, that you knew that Ready or Not was connecting when you saw people getting tattoos of your face on their shins. Yeah.
That'll do it, you know? Someone's getting a tat of your head on their body.
That's a crazy standard to set. Like, now you just have to expect that. You do expect that on every movie, Sam?
Where's the tattoo? You say
you're
a fan?
Have you met any of these people in person? Have you seen any of these tattoos in person?
Maybe. They haven't shown me their shins every time.
Yeah, because I was wondering how that happened, how that manifested. And people just come up to you and go, here is my shin. This is your face.
Yeah, oh, I'd be, like, tagged on Instagram, and I'd be like, wait a minute, that's my head on a leg.
Crazy.
weird, but so cool also.
Is that preferable?
Keep it up,
people. Is that preferable to having tattoos of your shin on people's faces?
Well, now that's a good question. That's a heavy-hitting question.
Yeah, less weird, more weird.
That they'd know what my shin looked like would be the creepiest part.
I mean, I was just admiring your...
My shins?
Your ghost tattoo.
That's going to show up on the set of Ready or Not 3 with your shins tattoo.
Right here. Right here on my cheek.
It's going to be the new craze. It's going to sweep the nation. So, in a way, has this been... Then you all the way through the Scream movies that you guys made, this was percolating in the background. This was bubbling away in the background.
Yeah, it was always that one that, you know, that like, I wonder, like, it would be so wonderful to be able to return to that. Maybe the universe will allow that to happen. And, you know, it's complicated with like schedules, and we were trying to organize. I mean, you were working so much and we were so busy, and I think like the stars align when they're supposed to. And I we're so grateful that they aligned, and that they aligned the way they did, you know, with Catherine as part of the mix, mm-hmm. and the alchemy of it and the timing of it. While I think we would have loved for it to have happened sooner, if it had happened sooner, we wouldn't be here with like this specific version of the movie, which I think we all love really dearly and feel really personally about. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
It needed to be like...
It needed to incubate.
We needed to all feel like, oh, this could be just as good, or if not better, than the first one.
Totally.
If it's not, we can't.
Yeah, there's no reason.
That's too much pressure.
Yeah.
And it did feel like, okay.
Yeah, we're ready.
Let's go.
I think it's going to be good, you guys.
I don't want to spoil too much, obviously, for this movie. But as you said, this does pick up where the first film leaves off. And I love films that do that. But I don't recall many doing it to the extent that you guys do
what
in this movie.
Are?
Halloween 2, Karate Kid. There's a few.
Yeah, Hellraiser 2 picks up where the first one left
off. But she doesn't age, so
Yeah.
You got
precisely.
I know magic.
There were real conversations about like, oh man, what is the clock on yeah. Sam?
That's when you say we don't need
like Grace from the first
I was
movie.
Nervous. I was going, it's been a minute.
Once we crossed like the 4 year mark, it was like, yeah. And then you show up on set and we were like legitimately like yes. shocked.
Jealous.
In every way.
Wear sunscreen, kids.
I'm weaving from, yeah, 2016.
I'm still 27.
yeah. Well, what is the secret? How do you do that?
Because no, I'm honestly
so much goos and the amount of money that I spend going to facialists, going keep me embalmed like an Egyptian. Like, what do they call it? Slugging? Have you heard of this?
No, what? I don't know if I want to know what slugging is.
It sounds like, disgusting.
No, you put like an inch of moisturizer on your face every night and like
just let it slowly soak really? Into your body.
Oh. All right. I thought they meant that they put slugs all over your face or something. That's where I was going.
No, you are the slug.
And then you have to wriggle your way into the door.
The amount of like blood that's been, you know, on my face.
So there's a lot of pressure. I mean, without going into too much detail, you guys recreate. It's the opening shot of this movie. You guys recreate the final shot of Ready or Not. Matt and Tyler, from your perspective, first of all, what was that like and how did you go about doing it? Because there's a little bit more that happens after that last movie finishes off.
Well, we didn't recreate the original shot. We actually used footage from the original movie.
Okay.
And then shot the continuation is new. And
there's
Sam,
a handoff, yeah.
Yeah, there's a handoff. Sam wore this, it's called a doggy cam.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. It's out here. And we did it on a pickup day. We did it fairly quickly.
Really quick.
Yeah. It was like we were.
For as pivotal as that shot was, and I think there was so much anxiety.
Arguably
about,
the most important shot in the movie.
Whether or not it would work at all on a technical level, it was, I think, two takes in. Brett, our DP, walked over and was like, is it? And we were like, yeah, it's fucking working.
It's
like,
work.
This is actually really cool. Really, yeah. Really cool. And
not for nothing, but it was super cool to see you on the steps again with a cigarette. It was just
cool.
Like, this is neat.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, and that the camera, and this again isn't giving too much away, but that, you know, a shot that starts as that, what has now become, I think, very memorable dolly shot, you know, as Grace sits down on the steps, that it becomes a camera that's attached to your body and is moving like in synchronicity with you. Is this we just love that the movie puts you in the first shot squarely in Grace's point of view, like quite literally, like you're on the ride with her. And it was a real technical achievement. And I mean, the amount of VFX, like the number of iterations of that shot and the stitch, and like it's all done with old school like pixel pushing, you know. It's all really a testament to how hardworking and incredible the team was, Lola, that you know helped us design the shot on a technical level. And and really, I mean, we held our feet to the fire. It had to like be photo realistic. It sort of lives or dies by that transition, that opening shot.
Yeah, Colin and that whole effects team doing the continuity of the blood was
wild,
amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So, but you did have to get Samara into the costume. Grace's wedding dress, be covered in the same amount of blood and goo at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was it? What was that like? Did it feel, I'm home. I'm home again.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. This is nice. I think it was a mix. It was both really exciting because I knew, oh, we get to do this again and I get to put this dress back on. That's was like, we're doing it, you know, but also at the same time going, oh boy. Okay. Yeah.
What did I sign up for?
We've read the script. Can't complain. More goo. Absolutely. Great. Love it.
I know. There must have been like some weird sense memory that was unlocked when you put the dress
PTSD
back on.
That
was like, oh, shit, I remember this misery.
Actually, do you know what? The first one, it was the middle of winter.
Yeah, that was
cold. And it was really cold. This one was sort of springtime, so it was actually all right.
It was only 4% less miserable.
And for some reason, the schedule, the schedule had all the big makeup looks at the very end of the day. So I quickly run and shower.
Get it all. Yeah.
I think the first time it was like, you're in this all day.
Yeah. And you start this movie covered in blood, and you're pretty covered for most of the movie.
What blood event you came up to Matt and I and were like, have you guys ever done this? When do we get to do this to you? So and we promptly turned away and walked
out. Movie 3.
Feeling very guilty.
Yeah, unless we're Ready or Not 3, here I come too.
I signed up for it. I signed up. I read the script. I know what I was getting into. Can't complain.
So talk me through that experience of on the first movie as well as the second movie, Samara, of being covered in goo. When a fellow cast member explodes, you're slugging. That's what it is. This movie slugging.
I'm just slugging. That's the real secret.
How much physical goo is there?
There's a lot. Okay. Didn't you guys have to ship in more blood this time? That's what Catherine's been saying, by the way.
That was on Abigail. She's got her movies.
Oh, okay. She keeps going, by the way, and I'm like, really? Okay, never mind.
Yeah, and there's no more fake blood in Ireland.
But we used about as much.
Yeah, it's like 325 gallons or something on this movie. Yeah. Yeah. Not including the tests, which I mean, I'm sure it's triple that amount with all the testing that we had to do.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And Tyler, Matt, you guys have actually never been slugged. We're going to use it as a verb now.
I feel like we're always collateral damage in some way. It's hard to not get messy on those sets. Like, it's really so disgusting.
Yeah. You're also the ones adding more.
Yeah.
You grab the bottle.
That's true.
And you go,
we add more.
You're quite hands-on in the sort of the Sam Raimi style.
I think it's out of politeness that you know the makeup department is usually like
very
delicate and like they're and we're just sometimes you just need like the blunt instrument. You need broad strokes, not small strokes. And I remember during the camera test designing Catherine's sort of final look and just being like, I'm sorry, I love you. You're going to have to pour like all this in your mouth.
This is what it is, yes.
But going back to the character though, after what, 6 years? 6 years between movies, Samara, was it tricky in a way to get back into grace? I remember reading an interview with Daniel Craig where in between Knives Out movies, he had to hire an accent coach to get him back into the Benoit Blanc accent. But you know, you have to kind of almost remember how you played a character 6 years ago because you're picking up right where it left off. Was that a challenge?
Yeah. Yes and no. I think Claire Danes talks about this about Homeland, that she feels like she hasn't prepared enough. But it's actually, no, you've already established the character.
Right.
You don't have to prepare that much. So I had this weird fear of, okay, I've got all the notebooks. I can see all the prep I've done before. I've like refreshed my memory, but
am I just being lazy?
Am I doing enough? Like, I feel like I got it, but it was pretty easy to pick up. But I think, oh no, you just have to trust that you've done the prep before.
You've done the work.
You just have to now you get to think about, oh, okay, what's the arc going to be for this one? And the script was so fantastic. And I think because I'd done it before, it was much easier to sort of like crack emotional beats. And I trust these guys so much that there was not a lot of anxiety around how do I find grace again. It was more, oh, let's go have a lot of fun. And now I get to bounce off of Catherine.
Do you think any of that has to do with the physical nature of the role and the first movie? That like, it's because I feel like one of the things that we always are just so amazed by your performance in the first movie and in this one is, I mean, it's just so physically rigorous. And I think your body remembers things, you know, differently than your brain does.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that was like, did you sort of feel anything familiar in because of the amount of action? I mean, you're running the entire time in the first one and in the second
for
movie
sure.
As well.
I think what was strangely emotional and maybe for all of us was when we had a fitting and I had the dress on again.
Yeah, yeah, that was wild.
Putting the
dress actually were
back
like
on.
Tearing up.
Yeah.
It was a big deal.
And I coming out and seeing everyone, I was like, why is it so emotional? Yeah, we get to do it again. And that really helped, the costume, having that on again. I was like, oh yeah, here she is.
I think that movie, the first one was such a like, it was the beginning of so many things for the three of us. That it, I mean, in addition to just loving the movie, I think what it's become and that people love it. Like, I think seeing you in the dress, it was full of all of that. That look is the thing, I think, the kind of iconic thing of the movie. And in so many ways, it was like, oh my God, this thing that we love so dearly and all the people around it and the people that helped us create it. I mean, it was all just sort of encapsulated in that fitting.
It was a real reunion. Yeah. It was great.
So, obviously the film this movie builds out the mythology of Ready or Not in very interesting ways that we can't delve into right now. But was John Wick, in a way, a bit of an influence on you guys in terms of the complexity of it all?
I think we mostly looked at, I know John Wick came up at some point, but I think it was mostly Terminator 2 and Aliens were the two movies that we kept going to when it comes to sequels and going, how do we, not in any way like stealing from them, but how do we achieve what those movies both achieved? What do they do to get from A to B? And we looked at those, I mean, endlessly through pre-production, through production. How do you expand the world? And then more importantly, how do you focus on the characters within that new bigger world and make sure that emotional core is there to, you know, get you through the entire thing the whole way? And at the end of the day, that comes down to Samara and Catherine.
Yeah.
And it felt like the movie got bigger, but it also gets more personal. And I think that was the thing that we were just always trying to balance.
Yeah. And I think the way that we referenced John Wick was, I think we liked the idea that the mythology grows, but that Grace isn't John Wick. Like, that's what we love about the movie. I think that's kind of the key ingredient, is that she is a normal person in the world of like a John Wick mythology. And that to us is like sort of the Rosetta Stone in so many ways for the tone. You have this like very real person in a situation and in a genre movie that is so extreme and so heightened in its mythology that it can only be terrifying and hilarious at the same time. And the fact that you're not an expert is really what makes it so fun to watch, that you're like improvising your way, through it is ultimately like, I think why you love Grace. Like, she's just like fucking scrapping the whole time. And that is where like the energy and the sort of attitude of the movie lives in that in so many ways.
I wanted to talk about introducing Catherine. Obviously, Tyler and Matt, you had just worked with her and Abigail. So was there a moment on Abigail where you thought, oh, hang on a second, or was Faith already in the script as was percolating away in the background?
No, there was a very specific moment on Abigail, and it was, I mean, I think in hindsight, it was building because we spent so much time with Catherine getting to know her. And as Samara was talking about earlier, they're both fucking weirdos. They're like, they've got a funny, silly sensibility. It's impossible to be around either of them without laughing a lot. And there was a moment when we were filming that was like, oh my God, Sam and Catherine should be sisters in something. That would be incredible. And so we were kind of obsessed with that idea. And at that point, we were not doing Ready or Not. And shortly after the movie came out, that's when Ready or Not re-entered our lives as an opportunity. And Trip called and was like, hey, is there any way you guys would do this? And for us, what we really wanted to get into the script was some emotional core. And the guys had had a bunch of, Guy and Ryan, the writers, had a bunch of great versions of that. There were other characters. There was another character in every draft, right? There was like the cop. Mm-hmm. There was
the friend from a daughter, the daughter.
Yeah.
There is a handful of swings at like that connection.
Like a partnership.
Yeah. But it was always like an unequal partnership where it was Grace and then somebody else she met, but it was Grace. And
right,
then,
that we were cutting away to, not that was like...
Yeah, that wasn't like integral to it. And right. I think the idea of her and Catherine together was so exciting just because they're awesome and they're great and be so fun to make that movie.
And then
this idea that like, oh, Grace has a secret. Like Grace was hiding something in the first movie. She's not perfect. Mm.
what if it was Catherine as her sister? And then once that idea unlocked, it gave us an emotional thing to latch onto in the movie that I think got us really excited. And the first person we talked to was Sam and said, hey, it's your movie. You remember this lunch we had at a,
yeah.
And it was like, this is, so gracious, you know, we don't want to like offend you, but we want to make this like a two-hander. And I mean, she cut us off and was like, oh my God, it's a great idea. I love it. Let's go. You know, it was like so open and generous and just like accepting. And then I can't say enough great things about working with both of them. I think we felt it off camera, and then hopefully you get it on camera. It's the chemistry is like undeniable.
And I remember, Sam, you saying during that lunch that the sort of one of the fears of the script as we had been developing it was like more of, it's just like a lot of Grace alone, you know, fighting again. And those moments were really fun and the sequences were great, but it felt like it was missing the idea that your character is playing actively against someone else.
The drama.
It's so different.
Yeah, the sort of real personal drama of it.
It was really helpful for me because I think would have just run out of ideas of how else can I be afraid in a different way, but making it about someone else and now I have to not only save myself but save someone else was such a great thing to play with.
Yeah, and the Sarah Connor and her son, like that relationship in Terminator 2 was like such a analog for us. Right. The idea that she's entering that movie full of all of the knowledge that that she's, you know, learned, everything she's learned from the first film. So it's cool for her to be a stakes character, but you want an innocent person to also be at stake, right? And her
Grace
son
would have
is
been
that.
Like, you know what? Just kill me.
Yeah, I'm fucking done.
Totally.
Yeah, what,
and by the way, that the families understand that complication exists for you is also then deployed as a really cool, like, you know, obstacle and complicating factor. It just gave us a lot to play with in a really interesting way.
Yeah, Guy and Ryan crushed.
And just very, very quickly as well, there is a sequence set on a golf course. Was that dangerous, bringing Catherine Newton onto a golf course? Did you have to drag her away from actually playing to do some acting?
I was trying to get her to play more. She got all embarrassed.
She hit one shot. In front of the crew, and everyone was like,
keep going.
What?
Ooh, yeah.
People love it when you play.
Come on. She's like, no, it's not.
I know. We had an idea in prep to like grow that sequence specifically because we were like, fuck, we got to get golf clubs in Catherine's hands. And then when the reality of like how you're actually going to pull the movie off starts to set in, it's like, oh man, we're going to have to like start sort of shrinking things. And
I want you to play Faith in the next one. And you guys do impressions of each other.
All right.
This is all fertile ground to explore in Ready or Not 3, Here I Come 2, which I'm looking forward to in about, 6 years' time, I guess, guys?
Yeah, sure.
All right, we'll all meet back here in 6 years' time, and we'll talk about that movie then. In the meantime, Matt, Tyler, Samara, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much indeed.
Yeah, great likewise. To see you. Thank you.
Cheers, guys. Okay, that was Matt Bettinelli Open and Tyler Gillette, aka Radio Silence, with Samara Weaving, the star, of course, of Ready or Not, Here I Come. None of this too nonsense. I am not going to do it. The film is out on Friday and is a lot of fun. Check it out, folks. But next up, something slightly different. Marianne Faithfull was one of the most memorable British cultural figures to emerge from the 1960s, which is saying something. A singer, a songwriter, an actor, an endlessly fascinating figure who led a life not without incident. She is celebrated in the latest docudrama from directors Ian Forsythe and Jane Pollard. It's entitled Broken English and is a fascinating look at Faithfull and her life, starring Tilda Swinton, George Mackay, Sally Ashton, Sophia DiMartino and others as part of a new agency dedicated to cataloguing cultural giants and making sure we don't forget them. Central to that is an interview with Faithfull herself, conducted by Mackay's character, in which she watches archive footage of herself. But there's so much more going on here too, including musical performances from the likes of Beth Orton, Courtney Love, Suki Waterhouse, and very movingly at the end, Faithfull along with Warren Ellis and Nick Cave. It was the last performance Faithfull gave before her death last January at the age of 78. It is a remarkable film. It is bold and distinctive, and it is being celebrated tonight, Wednesday, March 18th, ahead of its opening on Friday, March 20th, with a special screening at the Barbican in London, which will be live streamed into other cinemas around the country, and it's going to be bolstered by a concert featuring the likes of Jarvis Cocker, Rufus Wainwright, Beth Orton, Samantha Morton, and more. And the Barbican is where Forsyth and Pollard, who also directed the likes of The Extraordinary Miss Flower and Nick Cave's 20,000 Days on Earth, were when I caught up with them this afternoon. They were prepping for the gig, so there might be some noise in the background here, but we hope you will forgive that. Here you go, Ian Forsyth, Jane Pollard, talking broken English. Enjoy. Ian, Jane, live from the Barbican, how the devil are you both?
Very good. Nervous yeah. about tonight?
Just about nap time, I think. A little yeah. power nap before everything. That's getting very real very quickly.
Yeah, well, what stage are you at the moment in terms of you doing sound checks, that sort of thing, or is it...
Sound check starts as soon as we finish this, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, wow. So you have folks in the building right now, waiting, guitars and pianos all getting ready. So tell the people at home who you have tonight for this concert.
Oh, it's so exciting. I mean, Marianne is such a musician's musician, you know. She's collaborated with so many people, and we had people just queuing up to participate. So this evening we have some of Marianne's original band and the composers on our film, Rob Ellis and Adrian Utley, joined by Colin Greenwood of Radiohead and Anna Phoebe. I mean, we're spoiled, absolutely.
Adrian spoiled. From Portishead, all the heads.
All the heads, yeah. Ed Harcourt, Ed, and an Ed.
Head Harcourt.
Ed Harcourt, no, Ed Harcourt. Beth Orton, Anna Calvi, Nadine Shah of Jarvis Cocker, and Rufus Wainwright, who came to Sundance with us. Yeah, absolutely incredible.
So do you send out the signal, or and how did you get these people on board? As you say, Marianne, you know, is incredibly influential, but was it easy to get people on board? They just queuing up?
I mean, you know, it's Marianne that gets people on board, not us, really, to be totally honest. You know, people... Marianne was a real artist. You know, she might not have necessarily had the public profile of, you know, similar artists, certainly in the UK, but she had the respect and love of her peers. And I think that's what mattered to her more than, you know, the fame and the acclaim. I think she just loved being part of a community of artists. That was what fired her up in the mornings. So people were just really keen to get involved. I mean, it's, you know, it's been an embarrassment of riches, really, in terms of who was interested in the idea. But then, you know, reality kicks in and you've got to look at who's in the country and who's got commitments elsewhere. And, you know, juggling all of that, I think we've ended up with a really fantastic lineup.
Incredible, yeah.
It's an amazing, amazing lineup. And I want to talk about the film itself in a second. But the idea of a concert tonight to celebrate the film, to launch the film over here as well, where did that come from?
Oddly, it's very similar to what we did with 20,000 Days. Mm-hmm. Our first film with Nick Cave. It feels like that when you're making something like this, like an independent film, that you need to make the biggest noise you can on release. So you need to do something that kind of is a real moment of everything coming together, just to try and reach as many heads as possible, to, you know, to try and kind of break through and encourage people to get to the cinema and watch the film.
I think this will do it. I think this will do it.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the film itself. If anyone has seen, as you say, 20,000 Days or The Extraordinary Miss Flower, they will know that you have, I think, nobody does what you guys do. And you have this incredibly unique approach to movies about music and musicians. And you know, I've seen this movie described as a docudrama. I don't know how you think of it yourself, but how did you... I don't want to just ask about why Marianne first, but I want to ask about how you came up with the concept, this approach of this ministry of not forgetting that that is the backbone of the movie.
I mean, I guess a couple of things came together to kind of coalesce into that idea, but one of the big inspirations for us, and it's been a big inspiration to all of our work for a very, very long time, is the Samuel Beckett play Crap's Less Tape.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that Gary Oldman's taking on. We saw him do it in New York, and he's about to do it later this year in London.
Oh, he's at the Royal Court?
Yeah.
Yeah, which will be really exciting.
Yeah, super exciting.
You know, it's a wonderful play, and some of the greatest actors of you know, their generation have... Michael Gambon and John Hurt and Stephen Ray, and just a wonderful collection of actors who have taken on this role of Crap. And I think when we try to distill what it is about that play that really, really grabs us, it's this idea of an older man in this case, but an older person being confronted by their younger selves, and that idea of revisiting all of the people that you have, you know, all of us, you change throughout your life. Mm-hmm. You're never the same person necessarily from one year to the next. And the idea of being reintroduced to those other people that you've been at a later yeah. point in your life, I think is a really powerful.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about how what's so fascinating when you watch that play is it's the expression, it's the kind of micro gestures on the old Crap's face as he's listening to these audio spools, tape spools of recordings that he's made on his birthday over all of the years. And it's that encounter, it's that exchange. And I think that the sort of core foundation for Broken English comes from that idea of wanting to watch Marianne's face as she meets herself in the past. And not just herself once. There's an army of Mariannes who turn up for this film, and it was so joyful going through all of the archive, because she has been the same charming, fearless, socially conscious, intelligent, outspoken, challenging interview subject for throughout her whole career, and yeah, it was. We were right. It paid off. The cameras watching her face, really, that's the footage that I think sits at the very heart of the film and is moving, but is also universally, you know, accessible, because we're all dealing with our kind of past selves all the time. We're all navigating a kind of self mythology, a self storytelling.
Mm.
I guess the other line of thought that sort of played into that was, I think we feel very strongly that to make a film with an artist, to make a film with a musician, someone who's kind of created a mythologized sense of themselves, they've created a persona, they've created a body of work, and that's all of the reasons that we celebrate these people, that's all of the reasons that we're interested in these people. I think we often feel that films about musicians are trying quite hard to strip that away, to take the kind of mythology away and somehow reveal some unspoken truth about an artist that I don't think is very interesting. I don't think it's interesting for them creatively, and I don't think genuinely it's that interesting for an audience. You know, you want to live within the mythology that drew you to these people in the first place.
Yeah.
So these constructs for us are a way of keeping our subjects in a creative space rather than, you know, let's say a journalistic space. It's not an interrogation. It's a collaborative creative project.
And clearly you had that construct before Marianne showed up on set. That was your way into the movie. It's really interesting that George Mackay is essentially your interviewer by proxy. In this, I guess, how did that work? Was he a huge fan of Marianne's? Because he's unloading a lot of information on her. So were you supplying him with that information, or did he know his stuff?
You know, George is just the most, he's a bit of a muse of ours. We've worked with him many times on a range of projects, from television to drama to art projects and portraits. He, simply put, he's the best actor out there, and he's the most thoughtful and considerate and warm person. And I think that when we're working with actors, we need to know something about the reserves they're going to pull on, because our techniques are semi-scripted. You know, Marianne's entirely improvised. We run it a bit like theatre. I mean, it's three cameras, very little crew, and then we let the discussion run for like an hour at a time, and we're speaking to George on an earpiece so we can help him guide what's coming next, what to miss out, what to skip.
I mean, the truth is, he came to the project not knowing a huge amount about Marianne Faithfull at all, but with his usual enthusiasm and inquisitiveness. So he did the work. He did the reading. He did a lot of research off his own back. He did more research than we asked him to, because that's what George is like. But I think ultimately he just went into those conversations with such a deep sense of humanity. You know, he was genuinely interested in Marianne and what she had to say. And I think that shows in the film. You know, there is a real connection between those two people.
What was your connection with Marianne before you did this? This is essentially the why Marianne question, but I'm trying to ask it so obviously.
Yeah, but really neatly smuggled in there.
Thank you. Well
done. So, why Marianne? I mean, you know, like most things, there's sort of different answers to the question. I guess the most sort of straight line answer is we were presented with the idea by our producer, Beth Earle, who had begun a conversation with Marianne and Marianne's team about developing a film with her. And then Beth approached us to see if we were interested in having a conversation and meeting Marianne. When that happened, our first instinct was to think about who we knew, who knew her. And very fortunately, Nick Cave and Warren Ellis had both worked with her on our last few albums. And we knew that Warren had been working on an album of recorded romantic poetry with her. So we called Warren and said, there's this idea to do a film with Marianne Faithfull. What do you think? Should we pursue it? And he just went, fuck yeah. You got to. She's the real deal. You got to do it. So.
Yeah, I think that.
How could you not?
In a way, also, circumstances ended up making us kind of perfect for making a film that looks to recalibrate Marianne, because we had fallen foul of the playground gossip, the lie that the policeman told about her after Redlands, that the press then perpetuated, that was the first time I heard her name, was playground gossip. And so we had firsthand lived her reputation being broken, being stuck in England particularly. And I guess that gives us a decent chance of being able to approach the film with a freshness, you know, with no preconception.
I mean, the recalibration that the film is trying to at least start a conversation about with Marianne was very much our own recalibration. You know, this wasn't a sort of finger wagging exercise in telling other people that they've got Marianne wrong. It was, I think, a process of going, okay, maybe not completely wrong. You know, I know something about some of her work and how important she is to some other artists, but I didn't appreciate the body of work and the breadth of the work. And so the film kind of mirrors our journey of learning about Marianne, getting to know Marianne.
Yeah, I think the roadmap of the film came from sort of two things. Maybe the things that lit Marianne's face up when we were showing her them and when we were talking to her, we really listened to and watched that. So every time there was something of that, like with the Beat Poets or Dylan, you know, those moments, we would listen to those and make sure that they became building blocks for the film. And I think the other one was the moments in our process, in our research, where something just really revelatory kind of came about, you know, like the finding of the Seven Deadly Sins rehearsal tape. You know, that was such a, I didn't know that she'd done that project. I knew she'd taken on Brecht and Weil songs before, but I didn't know she'd performed that entire opera with a Philharmonic Orchestra behind it multiple times, like holding the stage as both of the Annas in it. I think truly incredible achievement, really incredible. And I think just how much that surprised and meant to us, then finding the rehearsal tape, it was like, okay, so there's another building block. We have to have that. Just looking for those moments, you know, never using reality or chronology or any sort of pre-established authority to try and work out what this film should be, but actually just watching Marianne and listening to our own hearts and trying to build it from there.
And watching Marianne, of course, you know, you had Marianne in the room. She passed away, obviously, last year. And there is a sense in the movie, you can see how frail she is. You can see that she is ill. So was there a sense from all parties, from her and from you, that there was almost a race against time in a way to get her to put her side of the story down on film?
There certainly was to begin with, wasn't there? I mean, the Marianne that we very first met, I would say, was the illest we ever encountered her, actually. But obviously there was no way of knowing that at the time. And I think all of us involved in the film and those around her, I think, were genuinely concerned that, you know, maybe there wasn't a huge amount of time left. Mm. So the whole film kind of geared up very, very quickly. And it sort of, it began to dictate a lot of the processes on the production side. You know, we went into starting to film without being fully financed, with, you know, Beth, our producer, just understanding we needed to grab this time whilst Marianne was, you know, at least willing and physically able to give us her time. So there was a real urgency to begin with. But the weird thing was that the more we got to know her and the longer we were working on the film and going to visit her, actually we saw someone who was getting stronger and stronger. You know, she was really working hard to get her mobility back. And the big thing for her was her voice. You know, she was, I mean, again, the film kind of mirrors reality in that when we filmed the conversations with George, she'd hoped to be able to perform at the end of those days. And she was just told there was no way that she could even consider it health-wise. So there was, you know, I think probably best part of 18 months between filming with George and then going into the studio with Nick Cave and Warren Ellis to record her performance. And over that time, Marianne was, you know, pretty much every week, a friend of hers, David Courts, would go and visit her with an acoustic guitar, and he would just try and get her to practice and try and get her voice back. And, you know, through stubbornness and determination, she did. So we were able to go and record that, which was, you know, an absolute highlight of the process.
Yeah, it was lovely because she was an artist who has defined herself through her work, but she was also a woman who finds her purpose through her work. And I felt like the longer we were working with her, the more purpose she, you know, the more resolve she almost had.
Well, it felt like that's what COVID took from her. You know, it took her memory and some of her physical abilities. But I think what stung, what hurt her most about having those conditions was that it stopped her being able to work.
Yeah.
And someone who for 5 decades has kind of defined themselves by their work and her, you know, her friends and her social life, it's all tied into her work, which I think is something we understand very well. Ours is kind of the same. Yeah. You know, the thought of taking our work away from us is just, in my mind, unthinkable. I don't know that I would know who I am without it. And I think that's where Marianne was when we met her. She was someone struggling to perhaps slightly redefine herself and her sense of self.
Mm. I'm so glad you were able to get that moment and bring that sense of self back to her. And that performance at the end, as you say, is absolutely incredible. Very, very moving indeed. And on that note, though, I'm going to let you guys go because you have a concert to get ready
sound
for.
Check. We have a sound check,
Yeah, indeed. So it's going to be very, very exciting. I wish I could be there, but sadly I can't. But I wish you all the best and thanks for taking time out. Ian and Jane, thanks
for your pleasure. Support. Thank you. Thanks, Chris.
All right, that was Ian Forsythe and Jane Pollard, and Broken English is out on Friday. Tonight's concert and screening is also being live streamed, as I said, at other cinemas around the country. So do check your local listings or the IMDb or wherever you get your cinema screening information and go and check it out. It'll be well worth your time. And there may be returns in the door at the Barbican to see this thing live. I checked about an hour ago. There was one seat in the upper balcony. So it may still be there. One last thing then. Hoppers is Disney Pixar's latest movie and an absolute laugh riot it is too. Very, very strong contender for the studio's funniest movie. The story of a young woman, Mabel, who for reasons far too complicated to go into here, quite frankly, finds her mind transplanted into the body of a robotic beaver. It gets more insane from there. It has been doing great business at the box office across the globe, which is heartening to see after a period when original Pixar concepts perhaps haven't been catching the public consciousness in the way that they once did. We have done a spoiler special on the film, which will be up very, very soon. Maybe even around the time you'll be listening to this, featuring myself, Helen O'Hara, Ben Travis, and John Nugent doing a deep dive into its themes and daftest jokes. But front and centre of that is a spoiler special interview I did with its director, Daniel Chong, and producer, Pixar stalwart, Nicole Paradis Grindel. You're going to hear roughly half of that, the first 12 to 15 minutes or so, now. Obviously, there are spoilers from the off, so only listen to this if you have seen Hoppers, or if you're a weirdo who doesn't mind spoilers, or perhaps you're a beaver in a human body. I don't know. Enjoy.
Daniel, Nicole, welcome to this spoiler special for Hoppers. How the devil are you both?
We're doing okay.
Yeah. Good?
Hanging in there.
Yeah, you ready for a spoiler therapy?
Yeah.
Bring it on.
This movie is a hoot.
Thank you.
It is a wild, unpredictable ride. I guessed about 10% of what was going to happen in this film. I have been racking my brains. Now, I don't know this for sure, and Pixar scholars will probably come after me for this, but I believe this may be the first film in Pixar's canon where the lead character inadvertently, admittedly, but nevertheless, murders another character. Now, poor Insect Queen, you get Meryl Streep in and then you squish her. And yeah, that moment where Mabel squishes the Insect Queen made me laugh so hard. But I also imagine it was quite tricky to get to that point where it's like, can we do this? Can we actually have Mabel squish another character?
You know, you could tell me, Nicole, what you remember, but my memory is it didn't get much pushback or question at all. I'll be honest, there's an interesting story to like us second-guessing ourselves because we were always worried that we might not be able to do it. And so we had the squish in there in a screen. We do like 8 screenings for every movie internally. And we show it to like the leadership, like Pete Docter, Andrew Stanton. They all take a look at it. They give notes and stuff like that. And we had the squish in there. Everyone loved it, laughed, never got a note on it. But I think us internally, you know, we work on this movie. We did like 6 years on this movie. Mm-hmm. And I think we were starting to second guess ourselves. And then we started going like, well, maybe, you know, if we're going to get this note eventually, there's no way they're going to let us get away with this. Why don't we change it? And so we started shifting it to maybe the Insect Queen just, you know, dying of old age in front of them. And then but then George and Mabel get blamed for it because they, you know, even though she died by herself. And then we screened that version for the Brain Trust. It was like maybe Brain Trust 2. And they were like, why did you do that? Why? Pete Docter was like, why did you change that? Andrew was so upset with us. And so we were like, we thought that, you know, we not get away with this. We didn't want our hearts broken, you know, when they changed it. And sure enough, they were like, no, we will protect it, keep it in. So I will say that those guys, leadership, they were like, we want it. And sure enough, they were right.
And I want to tell you, to be honest, I was never worried that they'd take it out. Mm. But I wanted to see what else you had. Because because you were pursuing something that was really fun and interesting as well. The other scene was really amusing. So I was like, well, let's just see what we've got here. But I never thought they'd make us take it out.
Okay. Well, that was us. You know, that's so funny that, yeah. You know what? You always say that the reason you think I second-guessed it was being in TV for so many years.
Yes.
I've dealt with standards and practices so much, you know, just I can't do this. And that was part of my process was like, you have an S&P pass where you just have to change a bunch of stuff. And I was self-censoring ourselves because of that. But thank you.
I think also the fact that it is played for laughs.
Yeah,
is a big element of perhaps why it got through, and I'm really, really glad that it did. And also, it does speak thematically to the movie also, because the movie is about, right from the off, you have that opening scene where Mabel acts without thinking and doesn't really think about the consequences, and that's something that runs all the way through
the movie. Human beings do kill insects that way.
Yeah.
You know, you can get all high and mighty about, you know, the principles. And then, and yet we do that. And it's something to be thoughtful about, right? How easily we can squish an insect. And, yeah. you know, you can, you know, worry about nature and then go out and have your, you know, your dinner made out of animals, right? And, you know, we have to find a way to entertain both things, as we do in our pond rules. Yes. We'll get to that.
We will get to the pond rules for sure.
High death count in our movie. I think somebody, that wasn't, no, it wasn't a note, it was an observation made by people on our team. Yeah. They were fine with it, they just commented.
You know, there's life and death, you know, that's what the natural world is all about, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the Pixar film with the highest body count. Is it this? Is it Hopper's or Bug's Life? Maybe.
Any cars die? Cars have died.
Cars too.
I worked on Cars too, and we were like, oh, I guess that car's not a car anymore.
Yeah. Right. We have to think a lot about that. You know? Yeah.
Weirdly, Up has quite a high body count in some ways as well. Yeah. And speaking of Up, I love the in joke at the end where Dr. Sam's bored of ideas with the talking dog collar. Is there anything else? Because I've only seen the film once, and obviously they don't allow you to pause it in a screening. Right. The other audience members get very upset if you yell at them.
We have a lot of Easter eggs, if you want a lot of spoilers.
In that shot.
Yeah.
In that shot. No, throughout the movie, actually.
But in that shot specifically.
Yes, the whole board has things. You know, at some point people will be able to freeze the frame and look at all the different details. It's really entertaining.
I think Up is the most prominent one. But if people pause it, are able to pause it in theater. Yeah. If people are able to just to
stop
see it again.
Screen.
Yeah. See it again. Rewind it.
In the distant future.
Yeah, there's Up, there's a Monsters Inc. reference, there's a Cars reference, there's a Lightyear reference, there's a Wall-E reference for sure. So there's quite a few films represented on that board.
And people will be looking out for the Pizza Planet truck.
That's there.
A113.
Pizza Planet truck is very small.
Okay.
And it's in the elementary school, the beginning. Okay. There's A113 is Dr. Sam's office. I mean, we're supposed to tell you all of these?
Yeah, like, please. Absolutely.
Right? People need to find them on their own.
I have
right?
not been eagle-eyed, so please help me.
Honestly, the truth of it is, like, I didn't even know where a lot of this stuff was until the movie was over. We were like, oh, man, we're going to do press. We were typing to our team, like, where'd you put everything? So we were informed ourselves late.
We have the Brave blanket. We realized we haven't been telling anyone that. So this is, you know, breaking news here.
Exclusive.
But the pattern on the blanket. It's on a stroller someone is pushing when Mayor Jerry comes out of his house and is waving. There's a mom there with the blanket over her stroller. And so that's a fun one.
That's amazing. Because obviously, right from the beginning, Pixar movies can be remolded and they're quite malleable, moving feasts in some ways. What was the last thing that you did on this movie, the last piece that slotted into place?
That is a great question because it really speaks to the things that we struggled with the most. And I think Mabel as a character was someone that we really – it took a lot of time to refine her, make her a personality that people would love and care for. And the last shot that we were addressing was to just make you connect with her more and love her more. There's a shot where Mabel has having a flashback. It's in the early first act, and she is remembering when she stayed home with her grandmother to live with her as she's getting into her older age. And there's it's just one quick shot of her serving her food and moving her hair. It's a very gentle scene, but it was a brand new scene that we had to concoct to kind of keep troubleshooting. How do we connect with Mabel and love her more? And I think this idea that Mabel sacrificed her life to go live with her grandmother and take care of her and basically, like, you know, until she passed away. It was just something that we realized, like, we need to see that she took care of her, you know, like grandma took care of her when she was young. Now Mabel's now taking care of her grandma. And so I think that was a very beneficial ad, but it was the last shot that went into production and we had to build everything within that shot brand new.
Yeah, and a lot of our preview screenings, folks also wanted more time with grandma.
Yes.
And we thought, well, you know, we can't give you as much as you think you want, but this one additional scene, it felt like tipped that balance a little more, and it kind of helped explain what happened to her, because folks wanted to know more. Wait a minute, she's gone? And so to see even the hospital bracelet, to see her struggling, and to see that meal helped explain that, and seems to have, you know, given folks enough to really root for her.
Yeah, she's a presence throughout the movie. The rock obviously represents her. That's the very last shot of the movie, which I wanted to ask you guys about. But I also noticed that you do go to great lengths to connect Mabel emotionally to her grandmother throughout the movie. We get little flashbacks as well, but there's also the jacket with Tanaka on it, and that gets burned up.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really, really interesting, bold move in a way. You're literally burning the connection she has to her grandmother. Can you talk about that? Because that's really interesting.
I think ultimately there are aspects of the movie that is about Mabel dealing with grief. And I think that grief is not just, you know, present in like what she's trying to do, but it's also the grief in the loss of this glade and loss of the environment and loss of nature in some ways, you know. And I think our writer Jesse Andrews was so pivotal to some of those conversations when we were developing all those ideas. And he always said that there has to be this moment of grief also for the loss of where the what has happened to the planet, and that once you can kind of go through that grief, you can move on to the future. And that might be a missing component for a lot of us, you know, in our ability to sort of process the shift that has happened in the world around us.
Yeah.
So I think that was very connected with her grief of losing her grandmother and not being able to process that, the grief of losing this glade that meant so much to her. I think all those things felt like they were working in tandem. So I think the loss of the jacket was kind of just another element that she would have to grieve over, you know, for what it represented.
Hmm. One other element, too, that I've realized as we've talked about this is the grief of growing older. You know, she's 19. She's been, you know, cared for by her grandmother. That was her companion. And kind of feeling like the grandmother ultimately is the, you know, authority, as we do when there is an older generation. Yeah. And this is the point at which she realizes, you know, she is now the adult. You know, she's grieving her youth. She's grieving that sense that there was someone else there, you know, to help guide her. And I think a lot of people are feeling that right now, that the older generation, you know, has stepped back. And as a younger generation, you're taking on the responsibility for all the problems in the world. And it's a heavy load. And then that is the moment at which that transition is happening. I have to figure out what to do next. I have to figure out how to move forward. And I think there's a lot of grief in that as well, when facing a world that has such big problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And those problems are seen kind of a microcosm at the end, where the human city is threatened, and humanity is threatened in a way by how we've treated the animal kingdom and how we've treated the world around us also. Mm-hmm. How difficult was it for you to balance those themes within a romp of a movie as well.
It's funny because, you know, the more we talk about the emotional stuff, it does feel weird because our movie is a very broad comedy. You know, there's a lot of crazy stuff in there. And that was what I chased first and foremost. The comedy was, that's the reason I got into this job, and that's why I wanted to do this, is I love comedy. The TV show I made before this was a broad comedy. Mm-hmm. So, I think I would say like our early screenings really chased those things. You know, we were just trying to make the goofiest, wildest. The movie was wildest movie. You won't believe, maybe, but we definitely had crazier screenings before, you know, that were even more like even more wild and chaotic. And but, you know, I think that was part of the process of making this movie, is we had to know how far we can push, how crazy could we get, and then we start figuring out, okay, how do we make sense of this now? And then I think that part of the making sense of that chaos is also adding that emotional layer. And then slowly, over the course of those 6 years it took to make this movie, it's finding that balance. How do we go crazy here, but make sure that this part is grounded, make sure this part is feeling honest and real. It was just a trial and error kind of thing, you know? And, you know, we have internal notes, you know, from our leadership that help gauge those things, but also a crew that's very connected with the movie and can help guide those things. So, yeah.
Okay, that was Daniel Chong and Nicole Paradis Grindel spoiling the shit out of Hoppers. And if you want to hear more of that, plus Team Empire talking about the movie, that's available now over on our spoiler special feed. And there aren't as many beaver gags as you might think. If you don't subscribe already to our spoiler specials, I can hardly recommend doing so. It's just £3.49 a month, less than the price of a cup of coffee. And for that, you get access to almost 500 spoiler specials, with more coming all the time. Can't say fairer than that. Go to empire.supportingcast.fm to sign up. On that note, that is it for this episode of The Interviews. Hope you enjoyed it. Not sure when the next one will be. Maybe next week, maybe the week after. Who knows? I like to keep myself on my toes. But it is enough for me for the time being. Right now, I'm off to play a game of hide and seek with you, the listeners. Don't worry, I'll count down from 10, 9, 8, get hiding, 7, 6, 5, quick, find a place, 4, 3, 2, 1, ready or not, 2, here I come. Yeah, the 2 just doesn't work. Doesn't work. Anyway, thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing Mountain Dew. So give me my good friends, give me a dew.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew.
Need a reason to smile? Comfort Dental has you covered with new patient exams, including x-rays, for just $19. That's right, only $19 to get started on a healthier, brighter smile. With convenient locations, flexible hours, including evenings and Saturdays, and a team that truly cares, Comfort Dental makes dental care easy and affordable. No gimmicks, no stress, just quality care when you need it. Get comfortable with Comfort Dental. Call or visit ComfortDental.com today.